I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program April Miller. She's executive director of the New Mexico Suicide Intervention Project, and she's here to tell us about the upcoming event called Wholehearted Therapist, Wholehearted Families. It's a one-day training on Friday, March 8th. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte, for having me back. I really appreciate it.
Well, we had you on last year talking about basically the same event, and I guess you really got some feedback from our conversation. People were listening and were seeking help afterwards.
People were listening and called up afterward to ask more questions about the conference. Some folks were listening and heard about our services and called up to access the services and schedule counseling sessions for their families. So really it hit both areas that we're very invested in, getting the word out that we're doing free family therapy at the Sky Center, a program of the New Mexico Suicide Intervention Project.
So let's talk for a moment about the whole phenomenon of suicide. Is it something that, I mean, people have been taking their own lives for as long as we have records of literature in civilization, but is it getting worse? I mean, do we have a kind of epidemic or a problem that's worse than it was before?
I don't know if it's getting worse, but one of the things that we have been, that has kind of fueled our passion around the issue, Mary Charlotte, is that New Mexico stays in the top 2 to 3 states in the United States of America for completed teen suicides, young people suicides. And when we've done surveys throughout our high schools in northern New Mexico, one of the things that we find that kids who have made attempts, when asked, did you want to die or did you want to change things, around 98% said, I wanted things to change.
Oh, boy.
So that's sort of our conviction and our work, is trying to help that opportunity get created for kids and their families. What needs to change? How do we make that change happen? So with that, we know that our focus is youth suicide, and that these kids let us know that their suicide attempt was really a cry for help, an effort to sort of make things change without the skills to know how to make that happen.
And so you're working with families to try to prevent suicide. How do you identify what families are vulnerable in the first place?
Well, we have access to some national research studies as well as our own that we did here in Santa Fe, northern New Mexico, looking at risk factors for our community, Hispanic youth, Native American youth. And we see that prior to an attempted suicide or a completed suicide, there are 3 events that usually occur in a young person's life: mood problems, depression, sadness, and they don't have the skills to figure out how to shift that, excessive family conflict, and stress or disciplinary problems at school. So with those 3 areas of concern, that really opens the door wide open for us when we're working with families at the Sky Center. Families call up with a whole range of issues connected to that, and we see them because, of course, we'd like to do early prevention. Those are the early warning signs. We'd like to get in there and work with kids and their families early on. So we do have that sort of understanding of what the precipitating events are for many kids who made suicide attempts.
And at the same time, those sound like, although they don't always happen all 3 at the same time, they all happen to virtually every teenager.
Absolutely. So we had this wonderful opportunity in our research project with the Center for Disease Control. We know those happen to every teenager, every family. So what's the difference? And the difference really boiled down to some kids sort of have an innate ability to problem solve, reach out, sustain relationships during difficult times, know how to go inside, take a pause. So we did a research study where we looked at kids who were really healthy, doing well in school, weren't showing the signs of suicide, and we asked them, do these things happen to you? And they said, of course. And we said, what do you do? And they gave us a real list of sort of life skills. So it was helpful for us to see that.
Like what?
Oh, walking my dog, listening to good music, talking to my grandma. The list was really extensive in that way. Take a hot bath, call my best friend. So what we kind of figured out is it's like an immunization package, sort of. Can we sort of offer those, what we're calling at the Sky Center, inner and outer life skills? The ability to reach out, problem solve, go talk to a teacher if you're failing a class, listen to good music, take a walk. And then we're also really infusing a lot around mindfulness. How does it, to go inside, take a pause, calm yourself down, take a deep breath. So we're packaging those inner and outer life skills and sharing that with families every night at the Sky Center. We have groups going on in the Santa Fe Public School around also trying to look at that as a protective sort of package that we could offer folks whenever they encounter these risk factors.
Very interesting, and I love that these life skills came from the young people themselves.
Exactly. I mean, we, prior to working with the kids who weren't vulnerable, we were asking that same question to kids. What happens when you wake up sad, mad, upset on the same day, and your mom and dad aren't getting along, or some kind of family issue happened, what would you do? And there was a long pause, and often sort of a shoulder shrug, and a, I don't know, or sometimes after a long pause, something like go back to bed, smoke a joint. So then we got to sort of get this information from kids who were doing well, who indeed were still dealing with the same life stressors, right? And found that there is a way that we can put this together to sort of share with kids and families.
What is the role of, I mean, if somebody's family isn't ideal and they're not doing well in school and all the kind of stressors that you're talking about, does it help for kids to be, even if they don't have a helpful adult in their life, for example, to go out in nature and be with trees in the sky, that kind of thing?
It helps very much. I mean, a lot of the kids who were showing these sort of protective resiliency factors in the face of stress were telling us that they go for a run, they take their dog for a walk, they go outside, a lot of them, you know, use the skateboard, go to the park, hang out. And it was really a major stress reducer for lots of kids, again, facing the same stressors.
So when you are working with a family that has a suicidal young person or a kid who has committed suicide, not only is it incredibly stressful for the family, it's stressful for the people taking care of the family, all of the therapists and stuff who have to deal with this, especially when that's your job and that's your specialty. It must be really hard to encounter that level of grief and remorse and regret and all the kind of things that people go through on a regular basis.
Absolutely, Mary Charlotte. And that's a lot of the focus of our Wholehearted Therapist, Wholehearted Family Conference, is we have seen this sort of toll that those kind of issues take in the field for school teachers, nurses, family practitioners, therapists, of a full range of therapists as well, those who work in school counseling, those who work in private practice, and of course those who work in agencies. So our focus, we've been training. Every year, the Sky Center takes about 10 graduate students from New Mexico Highlands University, UNM, Southwestern, and they come to the Sky Center, and they're really learning how to develop the art and trade of developing themselves as clinicians and therapists. So we're taking that 14 years of experience and really bringing it into this symposium on March 8th, where how does somebody develop their own set of inner and outer life skills so that they don't become victims of burnout, exhaustion,
yeah,
their own sort of kind of emotional and compassionate fatigue, their own experience of trauma that is ricocheting in their life then. So
right,
we have sort of a set of training skills that as supervisors at the Sky Center we are sharing with the graduate students and shared last year at the symposium. And many of the therapists and school teachers and nurses who came, they basically said, this is what I need. I needed this breath of fresh air and this ability to sort of get a set of sort of skills together that can protect me from burnout and exhaustion.
Let me guess. Go take a walk with your dog in nature.
That's a good one.
And all the things that you said the young people were already saying.
Exactly. And
Mindfulness.
We're doing a lot of work over at the Sky Center where our 10 interns are facing, often for the first time, night after night, seeing the unimaginable pain that families suffer from in our community. And they're feeling very thin-skinned about it. So we have our own sort of program at the Sky Center where one of our supervisors, Kate Reynolds, is running a cultivating connection, beginning practice for budding therapists on how to go inside, how to stay present while you still have a place of centeredness and groundness when you are hearing things that are really quite painful and derailing in a lot of ways.
It must be such a balancing act, because to be a good therapist, you have to be emotionally connected, and probably many therapists are thin-skinned.
Yes.
But at the same time, you have to kind of artificially thicken your skin to do the work.
Right, or we're sort of saying, you know, go inside and build it up really deep for yourself so that you have a solid grounding place. So when you hear this information, when you hear this, you can do this rather difficult thing of being very connected, very compassionate, and still preserve yourself.
We're talking to April Miller from the New Mexico Suicide Intervention Project. And so this is for all kinds of therapists and nurses and people who work with families, but they don't necessarily have to have the specialty of dealing specifically with suicide?
Not at all, because, you know, our, like I said earlier, Mary Charlotte, we're trying to keep the idea of suicide risk really wide range. Some families come to the Sky Center, they might have a sixth grader who is having a hard time eating, finding a lunchmate to eat with, right? So we see that on the continuum, if we can intervene and help her develop some social friendship skills so she can figure out how to walk up to somebody and say, can you eat lunch with me? That in the long range of things is a prevention for the family. So we're not looking at suicide directly in terms of the most imminent, desperate crisis of suicide. We deal with that as well. We'd much rather work with the fifth grader who's having a hard time with friendship skills and having her mom or dad or parent sort of help her with that in a family session way on the early end of the vulnerability spectrum.
We're hearing a lot more than we used to about bullying and cyberbullying and all these kinds of things. And I wondered if you had any insights about how the current, not only classroom environment in the schools, but also the sort of online environment was affecting young people, both in good and bad ways.
Yes, we've seen a real vulnerability. And one of the things that we have noticed after a couple of dreadful completed suicides in our community, Mary Charlotte, is that there was some communication online through the social networking that young people get involved with. And it sort of left a feeling for every kid who had either read a post the night before prior to the suicide that somehow or another they knew or they were involved. And it was painfully complicated for those young folks to sort of manage those types of deaths and grief after the completed suicide. So even in the most preventative way, we are really getting parents to sort of scoot in a little closer, keep the computer sort of in the family room when kids are young, know what's on the screen, check things out, wait a little bit longer until kids can develop more mature social skills before they get Facebook pages and are involved in the social networking. It's very different to sort of harass somebody face-to-face than to use your words in a social networking place. So we have seen that the younger kids get on social media, sometimes they overstep even without knowing. And, of course, they wouldn't say those words in the cafeteria when they were making eye contact.
Right.
So we're really looking at sort of the influence of media and asking parents to edit more, to stay close, to keep things out in the dining room, the living room, into family space, rather than the isolation of the bedroom, where kids not knowing sometimes can get in over their head.
What are some of the resources you have for a young person who is in crisis? I mean, is there a phone number that they can call, and does that happen on a regular basis?
It happens on the regular basis, where sometimes a parent might get a phone call from the school and the school is saying your child seems emotionally upset, come and get them, or, you know, we want to refer you to some resources. So one of the things I think that's really unique about the Sky Center, it's very local. Most of our funding is very local. I was at this wonderful organization last night called 100 Women Who Care for Santa Fe, who had donated to the Sky Center in New Mexico Suicide Intervention Project. So we get money from the Rotary, the Kiwanis Club. It's a really small, local, it's our community, and we're helping families in our community who are struggling. So we try to do some things like very easy intake, easily accessible. We're open every day after school. If families call at noon and they're worried about their kids, even if there's not formally a scheduled spot by 4 o'clock, we scoot some things around and make sure we can see that family that day. We know that if you're courageous enough to make the phone call that I'm worried about my child or my spouse is drinking too much or my partner seems depressed and isn't participating anymore in family life, if you're that courageous, we want to make the next step fairly easy. come in, the intake is simple. We don't ask about financial resources, citizenship, Medicaid eligibility. And the doors are wide open after school. We try to make sure that both parents, if there are two parents, or if not, we invite the other parent who's sort of been distant and missing into the after-school hours. We operate from 3 to 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday. We don't want kids to miss school in order to sort of improve things
right
at home. So we try to make those things very accessible, culturally sensitive. Families come in with painful, painful stories, and we help them sort of dig around for sort of what's working, where's the hope, how can we kind of stir that hope up a little bit and use it to motivate us to make some changes.
Right. Is there a place that if a kid, if a teenager is in trouble, they can call at 1 in the morning, that kind of thing?
No, well, there's a crisis line that's, here in Santa Fe that's run by PMS that we use to, we have that on our voicemail. We have it on our brochures as well. And the Sky Center, wouldn't be able to take a crisis call like that, but we sometimes get referrals from the crisis calls, right? The other, about a month or so back, we had a youngster find their way to the Sky Center, which sort of surprised us. She was a slight little thing and middle school girl who came and said, "My mom and dad are fighting a lot at night, and my little brother is too afraid to sleep in his own bed, and he's sleeping in my bed, and I was wondering if we could come over." And I think it was the first time we had a referral with a 12-year-old who sort of wanted to sort of sign her family up. And
that girl's got skills.
She's got skills and a lot of courage, especially when we were able to sit with her a little bit and said she had to call mom or dad and let them know where she was and that she wanted the family to sign up, and they got scheduled.
And they did?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
So we're talking to April Miller about the upcoming one-day training called Wholehearted Therapist, Wholehearted Families, and it is at St. John's College from 8:30 to 5 in the afternoon, again, Friday, March 8th. And so basically anybody's invited, they can get CEU, what's that, continuing education credits?
Right. For a lot of, most of our therapists in our community, whether they're licensed through the social work board or the community counseling board, we're offering 6 CEUs in ethics, diversity, and supervision. That'll be the focus of most of our workshops, the workshops themselves are focusing on really practical, useful things that therapists can do with kids and families in the therapy session. Really practical ways that therapists can start to develop their own practice of shoring up their insides and developing particular skills to prevent burnout and give them some sustainability over the long haul working with such difficult situations.
How do you do it?
We try to practice what we teach. We try to do that on a regular basis. We mostly, all are teaching what we need to learn, and we have been learning this over the years, watching some of our dearest, most beloved colleagues get exhausted, burnout, fatigue, sort of some of the work around how do you become a protector of the trauma that you're exposed to without it infusing into your own life. We also have learned by the hard way a lot, watching therapists have difficult times in their own families, sustaining their own relationships, because the work has come home with them and spilt over.
Well, also, I think a lot of people who are drawn to be therapists are people who are working out traumas of their own.
Yes.
And certain kinds of traumas are really going to get to them.
Yes. We see that all the time. It's like when interns come into the Sky Center for training, inevitably, not literally, but metaphorically, they walk into the first family session and there's their dad or there's their mom. And some of the wording is the same as what they experience. So how to be helpful, useful, connect with parents, and be present while protecting yourself is a lot of what this conference is going to focus on, really developing yourself as a wholehearted therapist, the therapist who's passionate, has an open heart, who doesn't feel they need to protect themselves around that, can be vulnerable, and still sustain themselves over time.
April Miller is Executive Director of the New Mexico Suicide Intervention Project, the Wholehearted Therapist, Wholehearted Families event. You can sign up for at wholeheartedskytrainings.com. You can also call to register 505-473-6191. And if you want to find out more about the Sky Center, the Mexico Suicide Intervention Project, what is their website?
NMSIP.com.
Okay.
And the Sky Center is the same phone number.
Okay, 473-6191. And there's also always, in case of emergency, either 911 or the National Suicide Prevention Line, which is 800-273-8255. It is really nice to know we live in a world where those resources are there.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you so much, April, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And I'm happy now to welcome back to the program Jenny Parks. She's president and CEO of the New Mexico Community Foundation. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, this is really, it's not only Valentine's Week, but it's really Women's Week in so many ways. 1 Billion Rising is happening on Valentine's Day this Thursday. And you are doing all sorts of things for women here in New Mexico. There's a new group called NewMexicoWomen.org.
Correct. NewMexicoWomen.org is a new fund and initiative of the New Mexico Community Foundation. And the reason we decided to start it is because the Community Foundation has invested in women and girls for a very long time and in a pretty substantial amount. But we realized as we went across the state having community conversations and listening to community leaders in different rural communities that we felt like it would be better to be more strategic, to raise funds, to really provide some education around the issues impacting women and girls in our state, to provide leadership around those issues, and then to help raise funds so that we can invest strategically in the nonprofits that are working to improve the lives of women and girls in the state.
And so what are you doing this week?
This week is an exciting week for us. We are going to have a presence at the legislature on Valentine's Day, February 14th. We'll have 6 of our grantees from all over the state, really, from Farmington, Hobbs, Navajo Country, Lordsburg, and here in Santa Fe, coming and having a presence as well in the Rotunda. We will participate with the 1 Billion Rising. And we also...
Are you going to do the dance?
I don't know if I'm personally going to do the dance. I haven't practiced, but I would love... I've never been in a flash mob, but
right,
maybe that'll be fun. We'll see. Anyway, and then we also are having a certificate of recognition read on both the Senate and the House floor on the 14th, recognizing NewMexicoWomen.org and the work that we've been doing and the work that we want to continue to do. And one of the things that we are also highlighting this week, we're having a private reception, a legislative reception on the evening of the 13th. And one of the reasons we're having that is to share with the legislature a new report that we have that will be coming out in April. The report is really an indicators report, and it looks at the lifespan of a woman here in New Mexico, from being a child to a young girl to a teenager to a mother to our elderly, because at different ages of a woman's lives there's different things happening for them, there's different needs. And so we're looking at how are we doing in New Mexico, and then how do we compare to the rest of the country on a variety of indicators that are indicators that would reveal, you know, women's health, women's well-being, what it takes for women and girls in New Mexico to thrive.
Who are some of the recipients? Who are some of these people who are involved with New Mexico, NewMexicoWomen.org?
Well, some of the grantees who will be at the legislature with us, Masada House out of Farmington. They are a transition housing nonprofit for incarcerated women. So they help women who come out of jail, may not have financial means, may, you know, need to get their life back together, learn how to get a job, that sort of thing, and they help them. The Santa Fe Indian School, right here in Santa Fe, the Santa Fe Indian School Leadership Institute, has a program called Brave Girls, and it's really about young girl empowerment, helping them think about their future and their education, and looking at building their leadership. There's another organization like that out of Hobbs called My Power, Inc., and they work with middle school girls about their own, again, looking at body image, health issues, trying to help them grow confidence that they have the power to have the life that they want to have. Finally, we have two others, Oso Vista Ranch Project, which is out of Rama, Navajo, and it's a traditional women's, they promote agricultural projects and work on that. And then Hidalgo Spirit, which is from Lordsburg. And Lordsburg is on the very south part of the state, of course, and it works with economic development for women in a place that's pretty depressed economically. So they're all going to be up here. I hope you the listeners will come by on the 14th. We'll be on the east part of the Rotunda, and we'll be there all day.
Is there any legislation that you're supporting specifically?
Not this year. There are a few bills that are out there that we do support, but we're not actively lobbying for them. There's a movement right now, of course, on the federal level to reenact the domestic violence law, domestic violence against women, which is expiring. And I know there's a lot of legislators from New Mexico, they're looking to pass a resolution in support of that. And we support that. And then there's also a movement to get an equal pay law passed, both on a federal level and a state level. New Mexico is one of the states that did pass their own equal rights amendment back in 1973. But currently still, New Mexico women make 77 cents on the dollar for what males make. And on the national level, it's 79 cents on the dollar. But in New Mexico here, it's even a little bit lower.
Do we get, let's say two people are teachers, is the male teacher getting paid more, or is it that there's still this divide between the kind of jobs that men tend to do and the kind of jobs that women tend to do, and women's work is less paid?
I think that's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that. I think that it's probably a combination of both, and as we continue with our research and looking at the indicators, hopefully we'll be able to detect what is it exactly that's causing that to be the case. I believe on the national level, when they look at those statistics, they are looking at equal jobs, equal pay for equal jobs. So I think that it's not just, taking an average of how much men make, comparing it to an average of how much women make. I think they look at specific industries and break it down that way.
Well, very important work, and the New Mexico Community Foundation is doing wonderful stuff. Jenny Parks is the president and CEO. Anything else you want to let people know about before we go?
Just want to mention that this year is our 30th year. We're celebrating at the New Mexico Community Foundation. We will continue to work throughout the state to try to bring resources to our most vulnerable communities and people, and we look forward to celebrating our 30th year this year. So stay tuned. There's more to come.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Sandy Buffett. She's Executive Director of Conservation Voters New Mexico. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Always great to be here.
And it's always great to have you before and during the legislative session because, of course, every year there are pro-environment and anti-environment bills that come up in the New Mexico legislative session, and that's what we're here to talk about.
Indeed. Conservation Voters New Mexico works to build the political voice for the environment, and we are a full-time environmental lobbyist at the Roundhouse, tracking all of the bills that could have any impact on our existing safeguards and also bills that seek to move the state forward in environmental protection.
And doing this legislative scorecard that some legislators love and others hate because
right.
You score people on how they do with regard to the environment. What are some
Indeed.
Of the bills that you're supporting this year?
Well, we're almost halfway through the session, and we have released our first edition of our legislative agenda, but we expect a few more bills to be introduced until Valentine's Day in the next couple of days. So We're also really excited, given that our pro-environment margins have increased since the last election.
Is that right? We have more legislators who care about the environment in the New Mexico legislature?
Indeed. In the House, we now have 28 champions and allies, and in the Senate, we have 19 champions and allies, according to the way they score on our scorecard. And also this year, really has been great because we not only have Chairman Brian Egolf chairing House Energy and Natural Resources, we also have Senator Peter Wirth as the Senate Conservation Chair, and that just means that bills will get the proper vetting they need. And we're not yet at a pro-environment majority in either chamber, but we think that we can get several bills through the legislative process and also work to defeat those that seek to weaken our protections on air, land, and water.
As you have successfully done in the past, both killed bad bills and promoted good ones, what are some of the good ones?
Well, we have some really great pro-environment bills this year, and many of them focus on protecting our water. If we lose our water, it's game over for our communities in New Mexico and our economic future. So we have to have common sense safeguards that protect what little water we have, and especially with climate change, we can't afford to contaminate a single drop. So one of the bills that we're supporting is HB 286, the Oil and Gas Modernization Act. It's sponsored by Representative Gail Chasey of Albuquerque and Senator Michael Sanchez of Valencia County. And what it does is it seeks to update the Oil and Gas Act, which was enacted in 1935.
Ah, you think it's time?
You know, the penalty section of that bill has not been updated for decades. And so, you know, that was when Nash convertibles were being driven. And in 1935, the fine from this act, $1,000 a day for pollution, that was equivalent to 2,500 barrels of oil. But today, that's roughly equivalent to 10 to 20 barrels of oil. But the fines have not changed.
Right.
We're talking about one of the most profitable industries on the planet. So this bill would actually just bring us in line with Texas and Arizona to increase criminal penalties on pollution at $10,000 a day.
Very interesting.
It also has... You know, the current fine structure, that's not even a slap on the wrist.
Yeah.
And another unreasonable standard that survives in the Oil and Gas Act is that this industry benefits from something called a knowingly and willful standard that the state's Oil Conservation Division has to prove. So that's akin to saying that the Department of Health, in order to assess a penalty, can only that against a restaurant that with rats in their kitchen, they could only do that if they could prove that the restaurant willingly allowed those rats in the establishment.
Oh my goodness.
So we think it's time to harmonize the act with other environmental regulations and give the state some teeth.
Now, there's another bill along the same lines that would allow for people to sue to enforce the Oil and Gas Act, but to sue as individuals if their property or their lives in some way are being harmed.
Right, and it's broader than just oil and gas. That's called the Environmental Private Right of Action. That is sponsored by Representative Georgine Lewis, a freshman from the Albuquerque area.
Yeah.
We endorsed her in the last election, and she's an attorney. And HB 429 would basically give citizens who are affected by pollution, and if the state is failing to enforce existing environmental laws, that they could petition to stop the company from polluting. And it also gives them a way to recover litigation costs. You know, often these communities don't have the resources to engage a multinational corporation
right.
in long litigation. So this private right of action would reimburse litigation costs should the local group prevail.
Very, very interesting. And so where the Oil and Gas Act and the Environmental Improvement Act and Water Quality Act, on the basis of all those, individuals and small communities and so on could seek their day in court.
Yes. And we also have some other great bills. The Representative Egolf's Water Resources Testing and Damages, HB 335. And what this seeks to do is to say that an oil and gas company needs to monitor, especially with fracking, whether or not this issue is a problem. And in many ways, this protects industry because it requires basic testing before and after the fracking operations. And if the testing shows that there were no impacts from the process of contamination, then that bolsters the industry's assertions that there's no problem with it. So,
do they agree?
I expect that this legislation will be a battle at the legislature.
Yeah.
But we just think it's common sense that communities should know what the baseline of, you know, what what their water quality is before and after those operations.
And fracking looks like it's not going anywhere here in the oil and gas state of New Mexico.
Not going away, yeah. There's also a Representative Egolf Bill HB 136, Disclosure of Fracturing Fluid. And this is simply a right-to-know bill of disclosing what chemicals the companies are using in those operations.
Which seems like I can't believe we don't already have a law.
I know. Well, you know, there is something that the Oil Conservation Division put into place, but it's truly inadequate because my recollection is it's a disclosure 30 days after the operation, and it's a non-searchable database of thousands of pages of chemicals. So it doesn't really give a community the right to know of what's being used.
A non-searchable database.
So
I thought that was an oxymoron.
We always support the more sunshine and transparency on what pollutants are being put into our air, land, and water.
We're talking to Sandy Buffett of Conservation Voters New Mexico. Now, there's another bill also that you are supporting that sets rules for homeowners associations.
Right. This is Representative Mimi Stewart of Albuquerque, another 100% environmental champion, HB 210, the Homeowner Association Act. This just provides for ensuring that if homeowners are part of a homeowners association and they want to install solar panels or common sense water conservation measures, that this act would limit what HOAs can restrict of their association. So it just, because we, you know, some of these HOAs have been roadblocks to clean energy and water conservation.
Really?
Yeah.
So if you want to have environmentally friendly clotheslines in your backyard?
Well, the act specifically names water conservation and solar measures.
Oh, okay. But not chickens.
That's a little. That would require another piece of legislation. Actually, we'll get to that in a moment. So there are dozens of great bills and memorials, and those are just a few of the ones that we're supporting. And of course, your listeners, if they want to learn more about what bills are environmental bills are that we're supporting, they can see our full legislative agenda on our website, cvnm.org.
cvnm.org stands for Conservation Voters New Mexico. And, yeah, I mean, I was starting to print that out, and there were about 10 pages of good bills and bills that you were opposing. What are some of the ones that you're opposing?
Well, in the last long session, a 60-day session, we opposed and defeated all 69 bills that were on our defense list.
Wow.
So sometimes the list can get very lengthy, but we cannot afford to take one step forward and two steps back in terms of our environmental regulations. So one of the bills that we are opposed to is SB 194, the No Agriculture as a Nuisance. This is introduced by Senator Phil Griego as the sponsor. You know, it really takes defense of polluters to the extreme. It proposes to exempt illegal, improper, negligent agricultural operations from nuisance laws that, you know, citizens can use nuisance law to bring a lawsuit, and this would exempt them from that.
And, oh, my goodness.
You know, CVNM is supportive of the right to farm. And, you know, in the cases where family farms have been there for generations and urban sprawl encroaches upon it and then there's issues, there are right to farm measures on the books. And this is not what this is about. This is really taking it to the extreme. So we oppose that.
All right. What else?
Also, HB 292, the Transfer of Public Land Act. You know, this, it seems unconstitutional.
It
would actually require an act of Congress for federal lands to be handed over to the states, but this state bill tries to do that, to say that federal lands and many of the federal lands that, you know, are protected areas, that would then fall back to the state.
Wait. You're saying that this bill would take federal lands and just make them state lands?
Well, it would usurp federal authority and transfer oversight to the state. First of all, we don't have the capacity to do that in terms of managing those lands. But secondly, we don't have the authority to do that.
So that's just weird.
And, you know, there was a Colorado College Conservation in the West poll released last week that said 77% of New Mexicans support our federal public lands. And we believe that those add to the quality of life and in this state and provide access to the outdoors. And so we oppose that bill. And, you know, then there are a couple...
What's up with that bill? Like, what are they trying to do? They just say, we take... That's like saying, we take the FBI and make it the state police.
Mm. You know, we don't know what the origin of this bill is, but we have a sense that these types of things are sweeping the country and various state legislatures trying to erode the authority of the federal government. And
yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
So,
I mean, not that it's a good idea, but it makes sense as a strategy.
Yeah. So, we expect that given that 77% of New Mexicans support public lands, that this bill won't move, but
okay.
I just wanted to mention it. And then there are a couple bills that seek to weaken our existing renewable energy standards, and we'll be fighting those. And then there's one bill, our capital outlay request, that we're concerned about, and that is two different requests combined, totaling $100 million for new pipelines down south. One of them would pipe water out of the Gila River, Gila Basin, and the Gila River is our last free-flowing river in our state.
Oh boy!
So
they want to make it into the Colorado River and just take all the water out of
the
it.
The state does not have the money, anyways, for this kind of massive capital project. But given that that was requested by the chair of Senate Finance, Senator John Arthur Smith, we're taking that very seriously, and we'll be watching those. So.
We're talking to Sandy Buffett of Conservation Voters New Mexico, and I just find it perplexing that everybody isn't a pro-environmental candidate, because basically we survive from our environment. If we have dirty land, dirty air, and dirty water, we don't have a good state, we don't have healthy children, we don't have healthy adults, we don't have a good economy. I mean, it's just a lose-lose everywhere, and
exactly.
Yet there's this sort of false dichotomy set up between business and environment.
Yeah, it is a false dichotomy. I mean, we cannot prosper as a state if we contaminate our scarce water supplies. And we certainly can't, expect the next generation of kids to be healthy and productive in the workforce if they're missing school because of asthma from ozone and contaminants in our air. So really, keeping our kids healthy as environmental public health issues, keeping our water clean, ensuring that they have access to the outdoors, this is really what we need as a state to prosper. And, you know, I want to go back to that Colorado College poll that was just released. It said that 67% of New Mexicans identify as conservationists. I think these issues, even if someone doesn't identify as an environmentalist, you know, understanding, there's a deep understanding among New Mexicans that that our water is our most precious resource.
Right.
And that we cannot afford to allow our water to be contaminated. But I think the challenge for CVNM, for the conservation movement, and for pro-conservation elected officials is really making the connection between arcane, opaque policymaking and the policymaking process, especially, which is not very accessible to the everyday New Mexican who's
yeah.
just going to work and feeding their kids, that what happens in the roundhouse has real life implications for our clean water and for our clean energy future. And so
yeah.
that's really the role we play at the roundhouse and in informing New Mexicans, is to serve as that information bridge and also to be the voice for conservation values amidst all of the industry lobbyists that we're definitely outnumbered over there.
Yeah, even though they're a tiny minority, I mean, those industries are a minority
mm-hmm.
within the citizens of the state, but I think it's also important to really point out that a lot of the people who support conservation values, it's not necessarily partisan. I mean, if you support conservation values, that doesn't say anything about your stance on gun laws or
mm-hmm.
church and state or any of those other issues.
Well, when you go back to where our Environmental Protection Agency and Clean Water Act and those incredibly important national acts were started under President Nixon. And, you know, Teddy Roosevelt is one of our great conservationists in our country. So these should be nonpartisan issues. We don't yet see that fully in our state legislature, although we certainly have a few folks on both sides of the aisles that will, you know, are fishermen, and that they hunt and that they love to camp. And so I think, and to get to a pro-environment majority, we truly need this to be a bipartisan approach. But, you know, working on conservation issues, that's such a breadth of issues that ranges from renewable energy to oil and gas pollution to planning, 40-year water supply planning to recycling. I mean, there's so many issues. So we work across the aisles on issues that specific issues that we know we can work with folks on both sides of the aisle. But still, unfortunately, it is a challenge. As I said, we're not yet at a pro-conservation majority in either chamber.
You do have a remarkable track record.
Well, it's
killing bad bills, especially promoting good bills.
Yep, and last seven sessions, we've had 100% rate of success of defeating every one of those pieces of legislation. And we've also passed, things that move the state forward, like in 2010, the Natural Heritage Conservation Act, which established a fund for river restoration, protecting working farms and ranches, but that was, $5 million, I believe. So we still have a long ways to go in terms of the need of our state.
You, Sandy Buffett, are going to be leaving Conservation Voters New Mexico at the end of this, the end of the session or this
after
year?
After the end of the session, yes. It's been eight really wonderful and inspiring years. And, it's time to take a breather and let someone bring some fresh energy to the organization. And I feel really great about the transition now because the organization is in such a strong place with our level, with our numbers of supporters and activists, a strong board. We just had an incredible election season. We have a political action committee, PAC, and that works to support and elect pro-environment candidates. And when I started, we were at around $40,000 in our PAC, expending in our PAC to elect pro-environment champions. And this last fall, we spent $400,000. We raised and spent $400,000 in the support of pro-environment champions. And that now, when we see the doubling of the number of 100% environmental champions in the legislature over the last 8 years, that's something I find a lot of gratification from.
Well, good work, and thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and we will perhaps get an update before the end of the session.
Great. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.